Hi, I'm Jesse Driscoll. I'm here with Christian Davenport, and we're bringing you the Raiders of the Lost Archive. Archives are repositories of special information. Archives can take many forms, historical documents, oral histories, or data sets that can't just be downloaded. We're asking questions to allow some special guests to speak candidly about their research process. The conversations will be archived here for the social science community. Thanks for listening, and enjoy.
Hey, my man. Okay. What is the topic question you are interested in examining for the research project that you were going into the field to collect data on?
I've been working on Ukraine for a long time, and I wanted to know more about the U.S. policy response set to the Ukraine problem. I started with the idea that I would work in the Biden administration if Trump lost. And he did. And so the Council of Foreign Relations was a mechanism to get myself into the government. I went on a year's leave without pay from University of California, San Diego. And the way CFR fellowships work is that you use the prestige of the fellowship to do something institutionally legible with your home institution to get a year of leave without pay. And then you market yourself to the interagency. And so I had to kind of make a decision about what I wanted to do in Washington, D.C. that would let me get close to Ukraine, get close to things that I was interested in. And I thought about a number of options, and I decided that what I wanted to do was actually go into the military. So I, with some guidance from some Navy and Army friends and colleagues, decided the best place would be the Joint Staff, specifically the Plans Division. That's J5. Of the Joint Staff, and I ended up working in the Europe-NATO-Russia division of the Joint Staff. I onboarded on January 4th.
Hold it one second.
All right. Yeah.
Okay, one, too many acronyms.
Two, all right, sure, yeah.
Two, have you ever been in the U.S. government before?
No, nor have I been in the U.S. military before. So in both of these ways, it was drinking from the fire hose of acronyms, but also just a lot of life experience. I did a lot of belated growing up real fast in the spirit you're asking the question. I've often been confused with someone who worked in the U.S. government by my students and by people in other governments because of something about how I speak and something about how I present myself. But it has never actually been the case that I have served in the U.S. government. And I had, for instance, never taken an oath.
I'm just going to go there. Or have you ever been? Yes.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So the answer to that up until age 43 was no. And then all of a sudden at age 43, I was surrounded by people who had taken an oath sometime in their 20s. And I had to somehow figure out how to become an insider and not just be othered and hazed for an entire year. And that took some doing, but I decided it was a thing worth doing, so I did it.
So directly related to that, I know we had a conversation about it, and you were kind of like preparing me for kind of like not being able to access you for a bit. And, you know, subsequently I was doing the same, but what were people telling you about going into this field?
So I got great advice from an admiral who I work closely with at University of California, San Diego, retired admiral, who basically gave me a typology of different types of people I would meet in the Pentagon, which was spot on, just dead accurate. And so I'm grateful to him for giving me that cheat sheet.
Can you tell us what that wisdom was?
You know, he had a couple different
acknowledging that much of this conversation is, if we stray too far off the path, you're going to have to kill me or something we're going to have beef. But so acknowledging that.
No. This is all more like where you stand in the Panda Express line type sociology. This is different useful templates of what's going on in the Pentagon and who's who in the zoo. And he had this.
Story someplace.
He had this very rich set of life experiences. He had done many Pentagon tours, And he was sympathetic to the fact that as a civilian, I didn't really understand what the Pentagon is or how it works at all. Without getting into his entire typology, which I think would take us too far astray, he said, you need to understand that there's a lot of people from a lot of different professional services that are just in the Pentagon, desperately wishing they were anywhere other than the Pentagon and trying to get back to their real careers in their service. But you have to spend time in the Pentagon in order to get joint certified, which is an important thing from Goldwater Nichols. And so the first thing to understand is
who's that Goldwater Nichols?
This was a Congressional Oversight Act that was passed in the 1980s.
Thank you very much.
This is the kind of thing that after some embarrassments in the early 1980s, there was a recognition that the Army wasn't talking to the Air Force, wasn't talking to the Navy well enough. And so they needed to establish for everyone's career promotion a norm that everyone goes to the Pentagon for a while. And so you get different people at different stages of their lives. But Thomas's insight was that you have a lot of people here who just don't want to be here. His other insight that was helpful is that there are a lot of people who look like civilians, but are actually pretenders, either because they are ex-military and now they've put on a suit, but they are people who are pulling down a military retirement pension, by the way, on the side, in addition to their GS-14, GS-15 job. But many of them are also carrying around resentment about why their career didn't go quite where they thought it would go. And, you know, this is a good life, but it's not quite the life they thought they would imagine. So those were two big insights that I got on the way in the door about the, you know, the working class sociology that I was moving into. I think the other good thing that somebody told me, Mike Horowitz, who was incidentally in the Pentagon at the same time, different floor, different part of the bureaucracy, great quip. No one in that building cares how smart you are. This is different from academia, because in academia, we've created this very cruel, straitated hierarchy based on determining who's smart and who's not. And in the military, in the Department of Defense, you will quickly find that people will quickly concede to you that you're smarter than them, but then they'll be interested in what you can actually do. And the quiet part, Mike didn't say this, but I found out that the answer to that question for me was oftentimes why nothing. There's nothing I can do for you. I mean, what do you want me to turn that Microsoft Word document into a PDF for you? I mean, like, honestly, I had no idea how to do anything that they wanted me to do at first. And it took a lot of bruising to figure out what the job was and what the job wasn't and what was expected for competence, how to not commit security violations, you know, that those sorts of things were not obvious.
Broadly, what was the job?
The job it can be a lot of different things. And I don't know how to generalize. I don't want to generalize too much from my experience, because I think that the crisis that everyone's been listening to on the radio or watching on TV overwhelmed the workflow. And what my job ended up being is not what it would have been in the absence of the Ukraine war, the way that it has escalated since February 24th. But our job in J5 is essentially to put words in the mouth of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So the Joint Staff, I certainly didn't understand this fully until I was there. The Joint Staff doesn't have much actual authority. If you pay careful attention to the org chart, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, interestingly, doesn't actually issue orders to people. What he does is he gives what's called best military advice to the Secretary of Defense and to the President of the United States. And so the Joint Staff serves this vital coordinating function across all of the combatant commanders. So the people who issue the orders are the combatant commanders. And in the case of my group, the planning division for Europe, NATO, Russia, it's EUCOM, that's European Command. This is like just what it sounds like. It's a combatant command for the U.S. military that handles Europe. And for historical reasons, even though Russia spans all the way to the Pacific, they have handled the Russia problem set primarily. So EUCOM goes all the way down to Azerbaijan, even though most people don't think of Azerbaijan as Europe. But it's a big neighborhood. It's a big theater. The chairman, however, is the one who gets called in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee. The chairman is the one who has a very ceremonial buck stops here feel to it when it comes to coordination across all of the services. General Milley is Army to the core, for better and worse. But he speaks on behalf of other services than the Army.
Oh, one second. So you said best military advice.
Yeah.
But you're not a military person. So I'm trying to figure out how your advice becomes best military advice. So
that's a that's a big question. Why would anyone in the military listen to Driscoll?
It's more like I don't view your scholarship as military scholarship. I'm like, is there something different about the idea of what's best for the military and what's best knowledge?
Yeah, so there's two types of things I think to unpack there. The first is that the kind of writing that happens in the Department of Defense is so unlike academic writing that it's almost apples and oranges. I mean, there's no attribution, and there are hundreds or maybe even thousands of people editing everything that gets up to the point that the chairman is signing it. So it's like a giant mutually edited wiki is much closer to what we're producing as outputs in this best military advice memo. And so what it means to be higher or lower in the hierarchy is at what point you get to edit a document. And a lot of what I would do to these best military advice memos is not, you know, sitting down and putting words directly in the mouth of the chairman. It's rephrasing a sentence or removing a block of text or actually just making a comment about, I think this might be escalatory. And the fact that I was allowed to make that comment bubble and then email it directly to someone in OSD policy is itself a kind of power. But that's very different than
OSD, help me again.
Sorry, Office of the Secretary of Defense for policy. And you're going to have to keep stopping me with these acronyms because
we will provide some legend.
I have left the part of what I learned ethnographically is that the whole building just runs on this sea of acronyms, and you get used to that arcana. So I'm sorry for the listeners out there, but the decision to go into the military. Let me take a giant step back here. Going into the Pentagon doesn't necessarily mean going into the military. Many of the people who work in the Pentagon are in the working for the Office of the Secretary of Defense, but they're civilians. That's what civilian control of the military looks like, is that the real power, at least on paper, in the org chart, runs through SecDef, runs through Lloyd Austin. And Lloyd Austin, Secretary of Defense. And so you have all of these acronyms, like ASD and DASD, that's Assistant Secretary of Defense, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. And even though Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, DASD, is that until you get your head around just how big the Department of Defense is and just how big the U.S. government is, a DASD sounds like they're kind of low on the totem pole. No. DASDs can hold meetings that are mandatory for the entire interagency to show up at. If it's an important person, and the Ukraine problem became really salient, so being able to work closely with, the team, or occasionally sit on an airplane next to a DASD is a big honor. It's a big deal, and so I got pulled into all of that. To answer the second part of your question, I got pulled into all of that because there was a recognition that I was what's called a SME, that's another acronym, that's subject matter expert, that I'm a SME on Ukraine. So I got pulled into this particular space because there was a recognition by certain people in the Pentagon that they were going to need a little bit more knowledge by someone who actually knew what the proper nouns were in Ukraine and could say the names correctly. And part of what it means to give best military advice is not just focusing all the time on trying to psychologize Vladimir Putin. It's also going to mean knowing where rivers are, knowing in an informed way you know, which parts of the east of Ukraine are going to be harder and softer to digest in a conventional military way. Some of this is just reading the tea leaves, but at a certain point, it is useful to know a little bit about these things. And there was a recognition that I did. So the fact that I've been writing a book about Ukraine for a long time allowed me to, I think, get a little bit closer to the room where it happens faster than would have otherwise been possible. And again, just to repeat myself, that does not mean that I was writing the best military advice memos at all. I was one of many, many thousands of contributors to a large process, full stop.
But two things. So you really didn't have any idea of how this would work until you arrived in the building.
Correct.
So in many respects, thinking of this as the field, did you go in thinking that this was kind of like I'm going into the field experience? Did you have that kind of parallel idea in mind as you were moving?
Absolutely. And part of that is idiosyncratic to me being me. I mean, I had just written this book about doing field work. So I was thinking about it because I'm an author. Part of it was that I haven't done anything like this since I had children. And it was such a large set of negotiations in my marriage for me to take a year essentially away from my family. And that's, you know, okay, one set of scripts and metaphors that you can use is the one my wife uses, which is cosplay. Like, this is you cosplaying being in the military, and I'm cosplaying being a military spouse. And it turns out it really sucks for the military spouse. Who knew? A different metaphor is field work. And that allows me to think about this through the lens of participant observation and stuff like that. So that's a little bit more flattering to my ego and more accessible for me to think about. It gave me some scripts I could run when I was really frustrated or when I was emotionally broken and crying under my desk about how hard all of this was. Is this like, yeah, this is really hard, actually, but it's supposed to be hard. You know, Tajikistan was hard, too. This is a different kind of hard under the halogen lights. But it's OK. You're learning things. So
you feel comfortable talking about how it was hard?
Yeah, sure. I can talk about some of it. It's a really dehumanizing institution, and it's meant to be. I mean, the military is really, it's not about you. It's about saving lives, other people's lives. You just have to get used to that. It's a very different corporate culture than higher education, which is the institution that I have thrived in for my entire adult life and very happily. This was bruising. And again, I think that's by design. That's one set of concerns. A second set of concerns that was difficult involved the loss of privacy and autonomy, which is something I value immensely. And just the fact that I had a top secret clearance in order to get in the door meant a couple of things. I could talk about them at more length, but you know, one of the first things is that I was required to put down on paper the names and contact information of every person who doesn't have a U.S. passport that I know. And if I am continuing to be in close and continuing contact with anyone, particularly any Russians, I just had to report it. And so I became pretty paranoid. I have a lot of mind wires that are linked up with paranoia as a result of, you know, certain like research that I did on the war on terror. And I had to get over that. I had to really recognize that, you know, I can hold all of that stuff in my head, that there are these people out there that I don't see myself necessarily in solidarity with. And there is a maybe an out of control national security state, and there's no off switch on that. And those people can ruin my life. And I have a job to do. So like how to actually square that circle was psychologically difficult. You know, like I liked thinking of myself as an oppositional intellectual in some of my moods. And all of a sudden, I just had to check that at the door. You certainly can't be cute with these people. You know, like you cannot lie to these people about whether or not you just had a drink with. She's a Russian graduate student, actually, and she is a Russian citizen, actually. And I guess it is close and continuing contact. I mean, that was new to me. That's not the, I became an academic in some ways in order to avoid having anybody have the authority to ask who I was having coffee with. I liked that made it possible for me to do the work that I did for my first book, for instance. And
in many respects, though, I'm wondering about the similarities here, because when you go to a new culture, and I like that you referenced this corporate culture, so you are entering a new domain with its own rules and regulations and so forth. And in order to function in that particular environment, you have to isomorphically kind of adapt to what's there, or literally be removed.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And in this case, the fact that the literal removal wasn't just shunning and other kinds of, you know, anthropologically studiable social mechanisms, it was literally going to jail. You know, that just raised the stakes of it a lot. You know, like if I mess this up, it's not just that I'm not going to get a book out of it, or, you know, I won't be able to see my kids because I'm going to be accused of treason because the stakes are that high. You know, that was really disorienting, Christian. You know, like that was just a different set of game board pieces for my psychology. And the last, I don't need to talk about this at length, but I think most people who have done this kind of work, participant observers, will recognize this. You have this romanticized idea going in that you're just going to be absorbed into the team and everyone's going to love you being there. But it because of class and because of any number of other real existing things that separate the life of the participant observer from the observed, sometimes people just resent you, period, for being there. And I worked very hard to try to do as best I could to become part of the team, but there were some people who never really wanted me to be part of the team, and I had to deal with that. I had to deal with that sometimes better than others. You know, sometimes I look back and I think I didn't handle it as well as I could have. But these are all professionals. Everyone had a job to do. But you can do your job while also hazing the lib. You know, you can both can happen.
Okay, so related to this, though, kind of how this is different from going into the field in a normal way that we talk about on the show. I'm just wondering, quite frequently when we go into the field, we're trying to collect information. It seems in this context, there's none of that. This is more of like I'm viewing this as a spewing, or am I wrong?
No. Viewing this as a spewing?
You're spewing information. It's information you've already collected. There is no new information that you were collecting.
So it's a little more complicated than that, and I have to correct that. I'm glad I asked what you meant. So I wasn't there spewing in Professor Driscoll mode. I mean, in fact, the trick was to somehow figure out how to convey information in this strange, heavily gendered, bro-y environment without ever going into Professor Driscoll mode. Like there was a moment.
It was a lot, by the way. You'll unpack that at some other time. But go, sure. go.
You know, but you learn about the corporate culture of how information moves through this building, and what you quickly learn, if you have any instinct at all, is that it is hardly ever appropriate for you to seize the mic, stand up, take a whiteboard pen, and explain to people what you think is going on, which is a typical way that you actually do communicate in graduate seminars if you're a certain kind of student. And there was just never a time when that was the right way to get an argument actually moving through the building. And the right way took me a long time to figure out, but it involves memes, it involves jokes, it involves elbows under the basket, it involves, you know, weapons of the weak type stuff that can gradually, slowly change minds in the Panda Express line. And it does cumulatively matter somehow, but figuring out how I could use the advantages that I had and work around the disadvantages that I had in order to get something done, different than spewing, I think. Now, the other thing to kind of pick up on is that I was definitely absorbing a lot of information that I don't believe I could have gotten any other way. Oftentimes information that had "Do not declassify until 2029" written on it. And so it becomes this thing where I now have a bunch of stuff in my head that I cannot write about and I will not write about. And I hadn't thought about the full scope of that problem as it relates to my academic life when I went into the building. I wasn't thinking about that, like, nexus of problems enough on my way in. I just wanted to have the experience. And now that I'm out on the other side, I'm immensely grateful that my Ukraine book was completely finished before I went in, because otherwise it would be subject to security review to make sure that nothing that I wrote in my book, which just arrived yesterday, actually, it's called Ukraine's Unnamed War, Cambridge University Press, 2023. That book was done before I went in. And so there is no mechanism where I'm legally required to let them read it and make sure that I'm not inadvertently releasing classified information. If I want to write in the future about what I just experienced, there's a process to make sure that I'm not inadvertently saying something that I shouldn't say. So I'm being long-winded, but all of this is to say that to the extent that there was spewing, I think that you've got the metaphor backwards. It was more like sucking. I was through a snorkel, I was drinking this new kind of information. Oftentimes it was information I didn't know enough about or couldn't have gotten any other way, other than serving in the military, frankly. It's weapon systems, it's ranges of drones, it's stuff like that. So
I'm wondering how that relates to other field work that you've done and how different this insertion into corporate culture is from getting off a plane in a new country.
Really, I'm going to have to be working on that one myself for a long time. In some ways, it's easier because you don't have to learn a new language. You have to learn the acronyms, but that's not quite the same thing, you know? And so because of that, because you're not literally working across a language barrier, you have more immediate faith in your own observations. So that would be the first thing I would notice, is that a lot of the field work that I've done is filtered through a very, very strong sense of, I don't even know what I don't know about what's going on around me, because there's so much white noise. And here, there's all kinds of secret codes, and you know, it took me a while to figure out what was going on, but the language barrier wasn't immediately one of them. I think that that doesn't mean I immediately got inside for all of these other reasons that are normal, but that was a big difference. I think the other reason that it was different is that I was not expected to be doing research at all. In fact, that was kind of twee. There was a war that was about to break out, and a lot of people were going to die. And my first goal, as a personal goal as a human, was to try to stop that war. My secondary goal was to not let the team down and make sure the chairman was prepared for his engagements. And then once deterrence, to the extent that we were trying to engage in a deterrent strategy, failed, it was to porcupine Ukraine. And that was a mission. And I was part of a team really doing something. And I have to say that that is not the way that I've thought about myself as a social scientist in the past. In fact, I have been, during the time of the global war on terror, quite skeptical of political scientists that would enter into these sort of cooperative relationships with the U.S. military to try to put their knowledge to work on policy. And there, I put myself in a situation where there was no alternative to that, where it was my job to put my knowledge to work to try to guide policy. And so we were not in a small war space. We were in a escalation management space. I had to stop, go home sometimes and actually read things that I haven't read in a long time that were useful, and then try to translate that into the vernacular of the building. It couldn't be shelling 66. It had to somehow be a 16-point blue bold talking point that might actually make it into a meeting as we prep for an NSC meeting or a deputies committee meeting or something like that.
I mean, I think part of the objection to the thing that you described, this bringing together of these different worlds, part of that fear or part of that objection was like, you're going to be putting circles around people's heads that could potentially be crossed off.
Yes. I was always really worried about that. So, and I've written about this at some length. The I've certainly reflected on the possibility that I would create ethnographic observations, like high quality descriptive work in certain parts of the world, like Somalia, like Tajikistan, that would be weaponized by the national security apparatus, right? Or that my graduate students would, right? That they would look at my example and they would say, oh, I see what you're supposed to be doing. You're supposed to be running surveys in Mogadishu. And then, you know, before you know it, you've created data that can be repurposed. And I've been very anxious about that. So on January 4th, January 5th, that's the person who walked into my cubicle, right? And you get there. And then, you know, you meet a whole bunch of people who are really smart. Not all of them, but some of them, enough of them are really smart. And they will quickly concede that, like, yeah, you know, when you describe it that way, it sort of sounds like we're all the Empire from Star Wars. It's like, yes, no, exactly, that's right. And then they come back at you and they say, yeah, but that's just the beginning of the conversation, Jesse. Like, the truth is that there are other empires out there. And they have their own Death Stars. And they really exist, like, not in a galaxy far, far away. They really exist, like, right here on Spaceship Earth. And, you know, yeah, America is kind of an empire. Oh, and by the way, even though I'm wearing a Marine uniform and everything, the war on terror totally sucks. I'm glad I'm not part of that, you know. But there are other empires out there, and we need to somehow figure out how to not have a direct kinetic conflict with them, because that could kill lots and lots of people. And that's kind of what we do in this shop. So that way of speaking that I just, like, performed for you, that was day zero stuff for me. And it took a while to figure out how to, you know, make common cause with people in this space. And I'm very glad that I was not working in the direct targeting part of the job, you know, drawing circles on people. That wasn't the space that I was in. That's a completely different part of this giant machine. We're more in the planning division. We're more up at the 30,000 foot mark. We're trying to design language that is for principals and for deputies on the political military stuff in the context of Ukraine specifically, that mostly relates to alliance maintenance, making sure that our talking points nest with the, you know, voting constituencies in our NATO allies. And the rubber hits the road on, you know, who's going to donate what from their supplies, sometimes with some expectation that the U.S. will backfill it. And the chairman gets on the telephone with heads of other foreign militaries. The acronym there is CHOD, by the way. And he gets on the phone and they talk as men do. They're all men, by the way. I never set up a call with a female CHOD. But, you know, they talk and, you know, setting up those phone calls, high level engagements. This is what the diplomacy actually looks like as a political military diplomacy, mill to mill type stuff. And that was handled through the planning division of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. One of the quips that I got useful is that a lot of what counts as planning day to day in terms of our work grind is actually party planning. You know, it's not necessarily war planning. It's actually making sure that the time zone in Bulgaria matches up with the time zone in Washington, D.C. so that the two parties can get on the phone at the same time and have a call. That's sometimes a matter of more consternation than I can easily describe on a podcast, just because everyone's time is so valuable. The main constraint, this was a big aha moment for me, but the main constraint in Washington, D.C. is the time of the principal, like the person at the top of the power pyramid who has thousands or, you know, on paper, hundreds of thousands of people working for them. Every single minute of their day is scripted. And that telephone call needs to land. And then it needs to, like, the business needs to get done. And then they need to get off the phone. And there needs to be an official readout of that meeting that needs to go out to the interagency so that all of the bubbles are flat. And the amount of time that goes into that is substantial, was for me.
Okay, so I was going to ask you about kind of like troubles and opportunities you encountered along the way, but you've hinted at this gendered element of the experience a couple of times. And so give us something on Like, what's your gendered observation that you had?
I think that it would have been different if I was on the civilian side. If I was an OSD policy, my immediate observation is that it's more gender balanced. Every time I went up to ASD Wallander office or DASD Cooper's office, both women, by the way, I had a very different sense of the sociology, and it was much more like a university campus. The military, by contrast, is more male. The particular group that I worked in was conspicuously more male. I don't particularly know why that is, but something about the Europe J5 Jader was there. When I went in there, there was one woman, incredibly impressive Air Force. She made colonel while I was there. I went to her promotion ceremony. And then this is in an office of about 30. That's 29-1 is the ratio. Then she left and she was replaced by another woman, also coincidentally in the Air Force, named Heidi. Ratio stayed the same.
For the record, every time you say J5, I think Jackson 5. Just saying. what's the most comical thing you encountered in this field?
Oh, I can't even begin. So much humor in war, and it's just how you get by, is that everything, if you pay too much attention to the horror of it, you go crazy. And so there's a lot of very funny stuff that has kind of a gallows humor feel. I'm not prepared for this question, and I'm sorry. I'm a little embarrassed.
All good.
But well, a lot of it was very funny. Because it had to be. You know, our boss, here, I got a good one for you. So my boss was this guy who's an Air Force civilian whose entire persona is being a kind of a big, dumb hick from Oklahoma, because that's how he gets it done. And he's always, you know, using this to hide the fact that he probably has a 150 IQ and is a meticulous, detail-oriented editor of other people's writing, which is a very important thing to be in his job, that he can quickly find the lazy typo in your quickly written talking points. And that's a huge, huge advantage. But his way of being is a lot of football metaphors, a lot of dirty jokes, a lot of salty, you know, it's just his management style. And it took minutes, not hours, for me to figure this out about him. Now, there was a moment where he was explaining to me that he wanted me to stop working on the various things I'd been working on first couple weeks on the job and instead work on a variety of things related to the chairman's Hill engagements, because he was going to brief the Senate. And the last time he got pulled in front of the Senate, it was about Afghanistan. So going into the Ukraine crisis, the going metaphor was the Afghan debacle. And because Millie had gotten really beat up over that, and we didn't want that to happen a second time. So there was a lot of energy in the building going towards making sure he was ready for the giving the Senate the bad news about the, you know, the what's likely to happen in Ukraine. And at this point, this is all public. This is all come out. But I was on the prep team for that. The funny joke was Jeff, this Oklahoma guy, talking to me in his office and trying to explain to me that he was going to put me on special teams. And he didn't want me to be on special teams because he wanted me to be using it in every play. And we both have these COVID masks on, so all you can see is the eyes. And he talked to me in football metaphors for 4 straight minutes before I finally interrupted him and said, Jeff, I have to be honest with you. I don't really watch football and I don't have any idea what you've been talking about for the last 4 minutes. I thought special teams were special. And I'm really honored that you want me to be on the special team. And this caused him to laugh so hard that he choked and then asked me if my wife watched football and that maybe I should tell my wife this anecdote and that she would never let me forget it. And so I'll share that with the podcast listeners. But that's, you know, that's the kind of thing that happened almost every day. Was one of these weird,
gotcha,
you know, straight out of Central Casting.
You slid something in there in the beginning, which is kind of like, if one focused on the horror, they would go insane. So if I can, because we do talk about this every now and then, is kind of like, what was your mechanism for kind of like self-healing or kind of like helping you kind of go through this experience. You previously talked about you had a notebook that you'd go to, you provide your notes, you do something that would help you kind of like decompress. But what was that? What was the process that you used in this context?
Exercise, and I kept a diary. And I think that actually really covers it, is that I'm pleased that I wrote my field workbook because I could read what I told other people best practices were. And the idea that I would have something that was not ethnographic field notes, it was just my diary that I do not intend to ever share with anyone or publish, that was helpful. And it was also helpful to just look around and look at how other professionals who are in the same place that I am, and they are professionals, are handling better and worse the same sort of thing. And if you're not taking time to take advantage of this multi-million-dollar gym that they have in the Pentagon, like, why not? You know, you're getting up early and you're staying late. Why not carve out time in the middle of the day? I'm not that important. Like, my time is not scheduled down to every 5 minutes. You know, that someone else's time is. So figure out how to make your four calendars work across your four different hard drives. Figure out where you can get a window in the day and, you know, go work a heavy bag, or, you know, go hold a plank, or go take advantage of the fact that you're in a place where there's a cult of the body thing happening all the time. So that's the answer.
So, we have a bunch of questions we occasionally, ask, but, I don't see them as either being relevant or as interesting, but there's one that we ask, which is, how did your experience in this field influence your understanding of the research process in general and data collection in particular?
So, I think the last time you asked me this question, it was about Tajikistan. And I think my answer was something like, I'm far less interested in violence. And, what I liked about this is that it took me from a ground level anthropological view of violence to the 30,000 foot strategic view of violence management, from comparative to IR. But, you know, the particular part of comparative that I have thrived in is really where comparative meets anthropology, is like Roger Peterson, Libby Woods stuff. And I'm now at the opposite extreme as in terms of my research interests. And I mentioned Tom Schelling before. I think Barry Posen's book, Inadvertent Escalation, did as much to help me prepare for what I ended up doing as anything else. And so I'm becoming kind of evangelical about that book. It's dated. It's from 1991. And I feel like someone needs to rewrite it. Someone who doesn't have a security clearance, someone who's not compromised like me should just go and rewrite that book, because it's very, very valuable. He uses Jervis, rest in peace, Bob Jervis, in a really, really useful way in terms of interacting the Jervis security dilemma insights from defensive realism with standard operating procedures and practices, operational practices of the U.S. military and of allied militaries. And it scares the hell out of you, and it should. And so that's the kind of thing that I'm thinking about a lot now. The fact that all of those words just tripped off my tongue. That's not who I was when I went in. You know, I was much more in a status hierarchies internal to Ukraine headspace. That's what's all over my my book that just came out, because I've been thinking about how to, I'm embarrassed to say, you know, for years I had been thinking about how to get the toothpaste back in the tube, and that was going to require some difficult intra-Ukrainian bargaining and intra-Ukrainian bargaining compromises, all of which are OBE. And what I'm left with is Cold War 2.0, deterrence, inadvertent escalation, where does China fit into it? All that kind of war on the rocks stuff is. Honestly, those are the waters I've been swimming in. I don't know if this is going to be true 6 months from now, but it's certainly true at this moment.
There's a great Spike Lee movie called Drop Squad. And part of this is about it's deprogram and restoration of pride, but they basically kidnap black people and reprogram them to be black. but there's a comment that they make in the film throughout, which is "Come back, brother." So I'll say that. But so what would you advise? What would you advise others who engage in data collection efforts, either in this space or generally? From this,
make sure that you get it in writing on your way in the door before you sign a non-disclosure agreement that you can publish things that are already in the pipeline, because otherwise you might have a difficult time publishing them. That's my first concrete piece of advice. My second piece of advice is if you work in security as a teacher, if you have a large number of military students, it is extremely valuable to walk a mile in their shoes in terms of understanding what their actual professional needs are. I think I'm going to be much better in the classroom as a result of this. So I don't know how it's going to change my research, but I do know that as a parent, I'm glad that I did this because I now understand how hard it is on military families. And that's just something I have to admit I did not understand until I walked a mile in these strange shoes. I'd always thought when I was a younger person, I imagined I was going to serve in the military, as I think a lot of young men do. It's kind of a gendered, it's a trope for a reason, right? Well, I thought about it anyway. I hear the lyric in the musical Hamilton. I knew that I was poor. I knew it was the only way to rise up. Like, okay, that was me. All right. So I thought back then that what it meant to serve, that the service sacrifice was some probabilistic chance that you would be killed or maimed. But then it turns out that what it really means to serve, it is different. What it really means to serve is a certain chance that you will end up in your 40s asked to leave your family, and for long periods of time, at a time when you have a family and don't want to leave it, which is something that a 22-year-old guy can't think about. I mean, not just doesn't think about, but like literally can't think about. And that's something that I get now in my bones. And so it helps me understand why the U.S. military is organized the way that it is. And that was going to make me a more effective teacher, I hope.
Hello. Thank you for listening to Raiders of the Lost Archive and for writings mentioned in this podcast, as well as what we're going to be doing in the future. Please feel free to look at archiveraiders.weebly.com.